not help, but the chief did okay in that department. He swayed a little at first, like he was light-headed, and Dean put out a hand to steady him, but Bitterbuck had already found his balance again on his own. So out we went. Almost all the chairs were occupied, with the people in them murmuring quietly among themselves like folks do when they're waiting for a wedding or a funeral to get started. That was the only time Bitterbuck faltered. I don't know if it was any one person in particular that bothered him or all of them together, but I could hear a low moaning start up in his throat, and all at once the arm I was holding had a drag in it that hadn't been there before. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Harry Terwilliger moving up to cut off the chief's retreat if Bitterbuck all at once decided he wanted to go hard. I tightened my grip on his elbow and tapped the inside of his arm with one finger. "Steady, chief," I said, out of the corner of my mouth, not moving my lips. "The only thing most of these people will remember about you is how you go out. So give them something good. Show them how a Washita does it." He glanced at me sideways and gave me a little nod. Then he took one of the braids his daughter had made and kissed it. I looked to Brutal, standing at parade rest behind the chair, resplendent in his best blue uniform, all the buttons on the tunic polished and gleaming, his hat sitting square, John perfect on his big head. I gave him a little nod, and he shot it right back, stepping forward to help Bitterbuck mount the platform if he needed help. Turned out he didn't. It was less than a minute from the time Bitterbuck sat down in the chair to the moment when Brutal called, "Roll on to," softly back over his shoulder. The lights dimmed down again, but only a little. You wouldn't have noticed it if you hadn't been looking for it. That meant Van Hay had pulled the switch some wit had labeled Mabel's hairdryer. There was a low humming from the cap, and Bitterbuck surged forward against the clamps and the restraining belt across his chest. Over against the wall, the prison doctor watched expressionlessly, lips thinned down until his mouth looked like a single white stitch. There was no flopping and flailing such as old Toot-Toot had done at rehearsal, only that powerful forward surge, as a man may surge forward from the hips while in the grip of a powerful orgasm. The chief's blue shirt pulled tight at the buttons, creating little strained smiles of flesh between them. And there was a smell. Not bad in itself, but unpleasant in its associations. I've never been able to go down in the cellar at my granddaughter's house when they bring me there, although that's where their little boy has his Lionel set up, which he would dearly love to share with his great-grandpa. I don't mind the trains, as I'm sure you can guess. It's the transformer I can't abide. The way it hums, and the way, when it gets hot, it smells. Even after all these years, that smell reminds me of Cold Mountain. Van Hay gave him 30 seconds, then turned the juice off. The doctor stepped forward from his place and listened with his stethoscope. There was no talk from the witnesses now. The doctor straightened up and looked through the mesh. "Disorganized," he said, and made a twirling, cranking gesture with one finger. He had heard a few random heartbeats from Bitterbuck's chest, probably as meaningless as the final jitters of a decapitated chicken, but it was better not to take chances. You didn't want him suddenly sitting up on the gurney when you had him halfway through the tunnel, bawling that he felt like he was on fire. Van Hay rolled on three, and the chief surged forward again, rolling a little from side to side in the grip of the current. When Doc listened this time, he nodded. It was over. We had once again succeeded in destroying what we could not create. Some of the folks in the audience had begun talking in those low voices again. Most sat with their heads down, looking at the floor as if stunned or ashamed. Harry and Dean came up with a stretcher. It was actually Percy's job to take one end, but he didn't know, and no one had bothered to tell him. The chief, still wearing the black silk hood, was loaded onto it by Brutal and me, and we whisked him through the door which led to the tunnel as fast as we could manage it without actually running. Smoke, too much of it, was rising from the hole in the top of the mask, and there was a horrible stench.
"Oh, man!" Percy cried, his voice wavering. "What's that stink?"
"Just get out of my way and stay out of it," Brutal said, shoving past him to get to the wall where there was a mounted fire extinguisher. It was one of the old chemical kind that you had to pump. Dean, meanwhile, had stripped off the hood. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. Bitterbuck's left braid was smoldering like a pile of wet leaves. "Never mind that thing," I told Brutal. I didn't want to have to clean a load of chemical slime off the dead man's face before putting him in the back of the meat wagon. I slapped at the chief's head, Percy staring at me wide-eyed the whole time until the smoke quit rising. Then we carried the body down the 12 wooden steps to the tunnel. Here it was as chilly and dank as a dungeon, with the hollow plink-plink sound of dripping water. Hanging lights with crude tin shades they were made in the prison machine shop showed a brick tube that ran 30 feet under the highway. The top was curved and wet. It made me feel like a character in an Edgar Allan Poe story every time I used it. There was a gurney waiting. We loaded Bitterbuck's body onto it, and I made one final check to make sure his hair was out. That one braid was pretty well charred, and I was sorry to see that the cunning little bow on that side of his head was now nothing but a blackened lump. Percy slapped the dead man's cheek. The flat, smacking sound of his hand made us all jump. Percy looked around at us with a cocky smile on his mouth, eyes glittering. Then he looked back at Bitterbuck again.
"Adios, chief," he said. "Hope hell's hot enough for you."
"Don't do that," Brutal said, his voice hollow and declamatory in the dripping tunnel. "He's paid what he owed. He's square with the house again. You keep your hands off him."
"Aw, blow it out," Percy said.
But he stepped back uneasily when Brutal moved toward him, shadow rising behind him like the shadow of that ape in the story about the Rue Morgue. But instead of grabbing at Percy, Brutal grabbed hold the gurney and began pushing Arlen Bitterbuck slowly toward the far end of the tunnel, where his last ride was waiting, parked on the soft shoulder of the highway. The gurney's hard rubber wheels whined on the boards. Its shadow rode the bulging brick wall, waxing and waning. Dean and Harry grasped the sheet at the foot and pulled it up over the chief's face, which had already begun to take on the waxy, characterless cast of all dead faces, the innocent as well as the guilty. Chapter 6. When I was 18, my Uncle Paul, the man I was named for, died of a heart attack. My mother and dad took me to Chicago with them to attend his funeral and visit relatives from my father's side of the family, many of whom I had never met. We were gone almost a month. In some ways, that was a good trip, a necessary and exciting trip, but in another way it was horrible. I was deeply in love, you see, with the young woman who was to become my wife 2 weeks after my 19th birthday. One night, when my longing for her was like a fire burning out of control in my heart and my head, oh, yes, all right, and in my balls as well, I wrote her a letter that just seemed to go on and on. I poured out my whole heart in it, never looking back to see what I'd said because I was afraid cowardice would make me stop. I didn't stop, and when a voice in my head clamored that it would be madness to mail such a letter, that I would be giving her my naked heart to hold in her hand, I ignored it, with a child's breathless disregard of the consequences. I often wondered if Janice kept that letter, but never quite got up enough courage to ask. All I know for sure is that I did not find it when I went through her things after the funeral, and, of course, that by itself means nothing. I suppose I never asked because I was afraid of discovering that burning epistle meant less to her than it did to me. It was 4 pages long. I thought I would never write anything longer in my life, and now look at this. All this, and the end still not in sight. If I'd known the story was going to go on this long, I'm sure I never would have started. What I didn't realize was how many doors the act of writing unlocks. As if my dad's old fountain pen wasn't really a pen at all, but some strange variety of skeleton key. The mouse is probably the best example of what I'm talking about. Steamboat Willie, Mr. Jingles, the mouse on the mile. Until I started to write, I never realized how important he... yes, he was. The way he seemed to be looking for Delacroix before Delacroix arrived, for instance. I don't think that ever occurred to me, not to my conscious mind, anyway, until I began to write and remember. I guess what I'm saying is that I didn't realize how far back I'd have to go in order to tell you about John Coffey, or how long I'd have to leave him there in his cell, a man so huge his feet didn't just stick off the end of his bunk, but hung down all the way to the floor. I don't want you to forget him, all right? I want you to see him there, looking up at the ceiling of his cell, weeping his silent tears, or putting his arms over his face. I want you to hear him, his sighs that trembled like sobs, his occasional watery groan. These weren't the sounds of agony and regret we sometimes heard on E Block, sharp cries with splinters of remorse in them. Like his wet eyes, they were somehow removed from the pain we were used to dealing with. In a way, I know how crazy this will sound, of course I do, but there is no sense in writing something as long as this if you can't say what feels true to your heart. In a way, it was as if it was sorrow for the whole world he felt, something too big ever to be completely eased. Sometimes I sat and talked to him, as I did with all of them. Talking was our biggest, most important job, as I believe I have said, and I tried to comfort him. I don't feel that I ever did. And part of my heart was glad he was suffering, you know, felt he deserved to suffer. I even thought sometimes of calling the governor, or getting Percy to do it, Hallie was Percy's damn uncle, not mine, and asking for a stay of execution. We shouldn't burn him yet, I'd say. It's still hurting him too much, biting into him too much, twisting in his guts like a nice sharp stick. Give him another 90 days, Your Honor, sir. Let him go on doing to himself what we can't do to him. It's that John Coffey I'd have you keep to one side of your mind while I finish catching up to where I started. That John Coffey, lying on his bunk, that John Coffey who was afraid of the dark, perhaps with good reason. For in the dark might not two shapes with blonde curls, no longer little girls but avenging harpies, be waiting for him. That John Coffey, whose eyes were always streaming tears, like blood from a wound that can never heal. Chapter 7. So the chief burned and the president walked. As far as C Block, anyway, which was home to most of Cold Mountain's 150 lifers. Life, for the prez, turned out to be 12 years. He was drowned in the prison laundry in 1944. Not the Cold Mountain prison laundry. Cold Mountain closed in 1933. I don't suppose it mattered much to the inmates. Walls is walls, as the cons say, and old Sparky was every bit as lethal in his own little stone death chamber, I reckon, as he'd ever been in the storage room at Cold Mountain. As for the prez, someone shoved him face first into a vat of dry cleaning fluid and held him there. When the guards pulled him out again, his face was almost entirely gone. They had to ID him by his fingerprints. On the whole, he might have been better off with old Sparky. But then he never would have had those extra 12 years, would he? I doubt he thought much about them, though, in the last minute or so of his life, when his lungs were trying to learn how to breathe hex light and lye cleanser. They never caught whoever did for him. By then I was long out of the corrections line of work, but Harry Terwilliger wrote and told me. "You didn't get it like the chief and Delacroix and Coffey because he was white," Harry wrote. But he got it in the end just the same. I just think of it as a long stay of execution that finally ran out. There was a quiet time for us in E Block once the Prez was gone. Harry and Dean were temporarily reassigned, and it was just me, Brutal, and Percy on the Green Mile for a little bit. Which actually meant just me and Brutal, because Percy kept pretty much to himself. I tell you, that young man was a genius at finding things not to do. And every so often, but only when Percy wasn't around, the other guys would show up to have what Harry liked to call a good gab. On many of these occasions, the mouse would also show up. We'd feed him, and he'd sit there eating, just as solemn as Solomon, watching us with his bright little oil-spot eyes. That was a good few weeks, calm and easy, even with Percy's more than occasional carping. But all good things come to an end. And on a rainy Monday in late July, have I told you how rainy and dank that summer was? I found myself sitting on the bunk of an open cell and waiting for Edouard Delacroix. He came with an unexpected bang. The door leading into the exercise yard slammed open, letting in a flood of light. There was a confused rattle of chains, a frightened voice babbling away in a mixture of English and Cajun French, a patois the cons at Cold Mountain used to call the bayou, and Brutal hollering, "Hey, quit it! For Christ's sakes! Quit it, Percy!" I had been half-dozing on what was to become Delacroix's bunk, but I was up in a hurry, my heart slugging away hard in my chest. Noise of that kind on E-Block almost never happened until Percy came. He brought it along with him like a bad smell. "Come on, you fucking French-fried faggot!" Percy yelled, ignoring Brutal completely. And here he came, dragging a guy not much bigger than a bowling pin by one arm. In his other hand, Percy had his baton. His teeth were bared in a strained grimace, and his face was bright red. Yet he did not look entirely unhappy. Delacroix was trying to keep up with him, but he had the leg irons on, and no matter how fast he shuffled his feet, Percy pulled him along faster. I sprang out of the cell just in time to catch him as he fell, and that was how Del and I were introduced. Percy rounded on him, baton raised, and I held him back with one arm. Brutal came puffing up to us, looking as shocked and nonplussed by all this as I felt.
"Don't let him hit me no more, monsieur," Delacroix babbled. "S'il vous plaît, s'il vous plaît."
"Let me at him, let me at him," Percy cried, lunging forward. He began to hit at Delacroix's shoulders with his baton. Delacroix held his arms up, screaming, and the stick went whap, whap, whap against the sleeves of his blue prison shirt. I saw him that night with the shirt off, and that boy had bruises from Christmas to Easter. Seeing them made me feel bad. He was a murderer and nobody's darling, but that's not the way we did things on E-Block. Not until Percy came, anyhow.
"Whoa, whoa," I roared. "Quit that! What's it all about, anyway?"
I was trying to get my body in between Delacroix and Percy, but it wasn't working very well. Percy's club continued to flail away, now on one side of me and now on the other. Sooner or later, he was going to bring one down on me instead of on his intended target, and then there was going to be a brawl right here in this corridor, no matter who his relations were. I wouldn't be able to help myself, and Brutal was apt to join in. In some ways, you know, I wish we'd done it. It might have changed some of the things that happened later on.
"Fucking faggot, I'll teach you to keep your hands off me, you lousy bum puncher!"
Whap, whap, whap. And now Delacroix was bleeding from one ear and screaming. I gave up trying to shield him, grabbed him by one shoulder, and hurled him into his cell, where he went sprawling on the bunk. Percy darted around me and gave him a final hard whap on the butt, one to go on, you could say. Then Brutal grabbed him, Percy, I mean, by the shoulders, and hauled him across the corridor. I grabbed the cell door and ran it shut on its tracks. Then I turned to Percy, my shock and bewilderment at war with pure fury. Percy had been around about 4 months at that point, long enough for all of us to decide we didn't like him very much. But that was the first time I fully understood how out of control he was. He stood watching me, not entirely without fear. He was a coward at heart, I never had any doubt of that, but still confident that his connections would protect him. In that he was correct. I suspect there are people who wouldn't understand why that was, even after all I've said.
but they would be people who only know the phrase Great Depression from the history books. If you were there, it was a lot more than a phrase in a book, and if you had a steady job, brother, you'd do almost anything to keep it. The color was fading out of Percy's face a little by then, but his cheeks were still flushed, and his hair, which was usually swept back and gleaming with brilliantine, had tumbled over his forehead.
"What in the Christ was that all about?" I asked. I have never had a prisoner beaten onto my block before.
"Little fag bastard tried to cop my joint when I pulled him out of the van," Percy said. "He had it coming, and I'd do it again."
I looked at him, too flabbergasted for words. I couldn't imagine the most predatory homosexual on God's green earth doing what Percy had just described. Preparing to move into a crossbar apartment on the Green Mile did not, as a rule, put even the most deviant of prisoners in a sexy mood. I looked back at Delacroix, cowering on his bunk with his arms still up to protect his face. There were cuffs on his wrists and a chain running between his ankles. Then I turned to Percy.
"Get out of here," I said. "I want to talk to you later."
"Is this going to be in your report?" he demanded truculently, "because if it is, I can make a report of my own, you know."
I didn't want to make a report. I only wanted him out of my sight. I told him so. "The matter's closed," I finished. I saw Brutal looking at me disapprovingly, but ignored it.
"Go on, get out of here. Go over to admin and tell him you're supposed to read letters and help in the package room."
"Sure." He had his composure back, or the crack-headed arrogance that served him as composure. He brushed his hair back from his forehead with his hands, soft and white and small, the hands of a girl in her early teens, you would have thought, and then approached the cell. Delacroix saw him, and he cringed back even further on his bunk, gibbering in a mixture of English and stewpot French.
"I ain't done with you, Pierre," he said,
then jumped as one of Brutal's huge hands fell on his shoulder.
"Yes, you are," Brutal said. "Now go on, get in the breeze."
"You don't scare me, you know," Percy said.
"Not a bit."
His eyes shifted to me.
"Either of you."
But we did. You could see that in his eyes as clear as day, and it made him even more dangerous. A guy like Percy doesn't even know himself what he means to do from minute to minute and second to second. What he did right then was turn away from us and go walking up the corridor in long, arrogant strides. He had shown the world what happened when scrawny, half-bald little Frenchman tried to cop his joint, by God, and he was leaving the field a victor. I went through my set speech all about how we had the radio, make-believe ballroom, and our gal Sunday most nights, and how we'd treat him, Jake, if he did the same for us. That little homily was not what you'd call one of my great successes. He cried all the way through it, sitting huddled up at the foot of his bunk, as far from me as he could get without actually fading into the corner. He cringed every time I moved, and I don't think he heard one word in six. Probably just as well. I don't think that particular homily made a whole lot of sense anyway. 15 minutes later, I was back at the desk, where a shaken-looking Brutus Howe was sitting and licking the tip of the pencil we kept with the visitor's book. "Will you stop that before you poison yourself, for God's sake?" I asked.
"Christ almighty Jesus," he said, putting the pencil down. "I never want to have another hoorah like that with a prisoner coming on the block."
"My daddy always used to say things come in threes," I said.
"Well, I hope your daddy was full of shit on that subject," Brutal said.
But of course he wasn't. There was a squall when John Coffey came in, and a full-blown storm when Wild Bill joined us. It's funny, but things really do seem to come in threes. The story of our introduction to Wild Bill, how he came onto the Mile trying to commit murder, is something I'll get to shortly. Fair warning. "What's this about Delacroix copping his joint?" I asked. Brutal snorted.
"He was ankle-chained, and old Percy was just pulling him too fast, that's all. He stumbled and started to fall as he got out of the stagecoach. He put his hands out, same as anyone would when they start to fall, and one of them brushed the front of Percy's pants. It was a complete accident."
"Did Percy know that, do you think?" I asked. Was he maybe using it as an excuse just because he felt like wailing on Delacroix a little bit, showing him who bosses the shooting match around here? Brutal nodded slowly. Yeah, I think that was probably it. We have to watch him, then, I said, and ran my hands through my hair, as if the job wasn't hard enough. God, I hate this. I hate him. Me too. And you want to know something else, Paul? I don't understand him. He's got connections. I understand that, all right, but why would he use them to get a job on the Green fucking Mile? Anywhere in the state pen, for that matter. Why not as a page in the state senate, or the guy who makes the lieutenant governor's appointments? Surely his people could have gotten him something better if he'd asked them, so why here? I shook my head. I didn't know. There were a lot of things I didn't know then. I suppose I was naive. Chapter 8. After that, things went back to normal again, for a while, at least. Down in the county seat, the state was preparing to bring John Coffey to trial as soon as they could, and Trepingas County Sheriff Homer Kribus was poo-pooing the idea that a lynch mob might hurry justice along a little bit. None of that mattered to us. On E Block, no one paid much attention to the news. Life on the Green Mile was, in a way, like life in a soundproof room. From time to time, you heard mutterings that were probably explosions in the outside world, but that was about all. They wouldn't hurry with John Coffey. They'd want to make damn sure of him. On a couple of occasions, Percy got to ragging Delacroix, and the second time I pulled him aside and told him to come up to my office. It wasn't my first interview with Percy on the subject of his behavior, and it wouldn't be the last, but it was prompted by what was probably the clearest understanding of what he was. He had the heart of a cruel boy who goes to the zoo not so he can study the animals, but so he can throw stones at them in their cages. You stay away from him now, you hear? I said. Unless I give you a specific order, just stay the hell away from him. Percy combed his hair back, then patted at it with his sweet little hands. That boy just loved touching his hair. I wasn't doing nothing to him. He said, only asking how it felt to know you'd burned up some babies is all. Percy gave me a round-eyed, innocent stare. You quit with it, or there'll be a report, I said. He laughed. Make any report you want, he said. Then I'll turn around and make my own, just like I told you when he came in. We'll see who comes off the best. I leaned forward, hands folded on my desk, and spoke in a tone I hoped would sound like a friend being confidential. Brutus Howell doesn't like you much, I said. And when Brutal doesn't like someone, he's been known to make his own report. He isn't much shakes with a pen, and he can't quit from licking that pencil, so he's apt to report with his fists, if you know what I mean. Percy's complacent little smile faltered. What are you trying to say? I'm not trying to say anything. I have said it. And if you tell any of your friends about this discussion, I'll say you made the whole thing up. I looked at him all wide-eyed and earnest. Besides, I'm trying to be your friend, Percy. A word to the wise is sufficient, they say. And why would you want to get into it with Delacroix in the first place? He's not worth it. And for a while that worked. There was peace. A couple of times I was even able to send Percy with Dean or Harry when Delacroix's time to shower had rolled around. We had the radio at night. Delacroix began to relax a little into the scant routine of E Block. And there was peace. Then one night I heard him laughing. Harry Terwilliger was on the desk, and soon he was laughing, too. I got up and went on down to Delacroix's cell to see what he possibly had to laugh about.
"Look, Captain," he said when he saw me. "I don't tame me a mouse."
It was Steamboat Willie. He was in Delacroix's cell. More, he was sitting on Delacroix's shoulder and looking calmly out through the bars at us with his little oil-drop eyes. His tail was curled around his paws, and he looked completely at peace. As for Delacroix, friend, you wouldn't have known it was the same man who'd sat cringing and shuddering at the foot of his bunk not a week before. He looked like my daughter used to on Christmas morning when she came down the stairs and saw the presents.
"Watch this,"
Delacroix said. The mouse was sitting on his right shoulder. Delacroix stretched out his left arm. The mouse scampered up to the top of Delacroix's head, using the man's hair, which was thick enough in back at least, to climb up. Then he scampered down the other side, Delacroix giggling as his tail tickled the side of his neck. The mouse ran all the way down his arm to his wrist, then turned, scampered back up to Delacroix's left shoulder, and curled his tail around his feet again.
"I'll be damned," Harry said. "I train him to do that," Delacroix said proudly.
I thought, "In a pig's ass you did," but kept my mouth shut.
"His name is Mr. Jingles."
"No," Harry said good-naturedly. "It's Steamboat Willie, like in the picture show. Boss Howell named him."
"It's Mr. Jingles," Delacroix said.
On any other subject, he would have told you that shit was Shinola if you wanted him to, but on the subject of the mouse's name, he was perfectly adamant.
"He whispered it in my ear. Cap'n, can I have a box for him? Can I have a box for my mouse so he can sleep in here with me?"
His voice began to fall into wheedling tones I had heard a thousand times before.
"I put him under my bunk, and he never be a screed of trouble, not one."
"Your English gets a hell of a lot better when you want something," I said, stalling for time. "Uh-oh," Harry murmured, nudging me. "Here comes trouble." But Percy didn't look like trouble to me, not that night. He wasn't running his hands through his hair or fiddling with that baton of his, and the top button of his uniform shirt was actually undone. It was the first time I'd seen him that way, and it was amazing what a change a little thing like that could make. Mostly, though, what struck me was the expression on his face. There was a calmness there. Not serenity. I don't think Percy Wetmore had a serene bone in his body, but the look of a man who has discovered he can wait for the things he wants. It was quite a change from the young man I'd had to threaten with Brutus Howell's fists only a few days before, I can tell you that. Delacroix didn't see the change, though. He cringed against the wall of his cell, drawing his knees up to his chest. His eyes seemed to grow until they were taking up half his face. The mouse scampered up on his bald pate and sat there. I don't know if he remembered that he also had reason to distrust Percy, but it certainly looked as if he did. Probably it was just smelling the little Frenchman's fear and reacting off that.
"Well, well," Percy said. "Looks like you found yourself a friend, Eddie."
Delacroix tried to reply. Some hollow defiance about what would happen to Percy if Percy hurt his new pal would have been my guess, but nothing came out. His lower lip trembled a little, but that was all. On top of his head, Mr. Jingles wasn't trembling. He sat perfectly still with his back feet in Delacroix's hair and his front ones splayed on Delacroix's bald skull, looking at Percy, seeming to size him up, the way you'd size up an old enemy. Percy looked at me.
"Isn't that the same one I chased? The one that lives in a restraint room?"
I nodded. I had an idea Percy hadn't seen the newly named Mr. Jingle since that last chase, and he showed no signs of wanting to chase it now. "Yes, that's the one," I said. "Only Delacroix there says his name is Mr. Jingles, not Steamboat Willie. Says the mouse whispered it in his ear."
"Is that so?" Percy said. "Wonders never cease, do they?"
I half expected him to pull out his baton and start tapping it against the bars just to show Delacroix who was boss, but he only stood there with his hands on his hips looking in. And for no reason I could have told you in words, I said, "Delacroix there was just asking for a box, Percy. He thinks that mouse'll sleep in it, I guess, that he can keep it for a pet." I loaded my voice with skepticism and sensed more than saw Harry looking at me in surprise. "What do you think about that?"
"I think it'll probably shit up his nose some night while he's sleeping and then run away," Percy said evenly.
But I guess that's a French boy's lookout. I seen a pretty nice cigar box on Toot Toot's cart the other night. I don't know if he'd give it away, though. Probably want a nickel for it, maybe even a dime. Now I did risk a glance at Harry and saw his mouth hanging open. This wasn't quite like the change in Ebenezer Scrooge on Christmas morning after the ghosts had had their way with him, but it was damned close. Percy leaned closer to Delacroix, putting his face between the bars. Delacroix shrank back even further. I swear to God that he would have melted into that wall if he'd been able.
"You got a nickel, or maybe as much as a dime to pay for a cigar box, you lagoon?" he asked.
"I got 4 pennies," Delacroix said. "I give dam for a box if he'd a good one, c'est le bon."
"I'll tell you what," Percy said. "If that toothless old whoremaster will sell you that Corona box for 4 cents, I'll sneak some cotton batting out of the dispensary to line it with. We'll make us a regular Mousy Hilton before we're through." He switched his eyes to me. "I'm supposed to write a switch room report about Bitterbuck," he said. "Is there some pens in your office, Paul?"
"Yes, indeed," I said. "Forms, too, left-hand top drawer."
"Well, that's aces," he said, and went swaggering off. Harry and I looked at each other.
"Is he sick, you think?"
Harry asked. "Maybe went to his doctor and found out he's only got 3 months to live?"
I told him I didn't have the slightest idea what was up. It was the truth then, and for a while after, but I found out in time. And a few years later, I had an interesting supper table conversation with Hal Moores. By then, we could talk freely, what with him being retired and me being at the boys' correctional. It was one of those meals where you drink too much and eat too little and tongues get loosened. Hal told me that Percy had been in to complain about me and about life on the mile in general. This was just after Delacroix came on the block and Brutal and I had kept Percy from beating him half to death. What had griped Percy the most was me telling him to get out of my sight. He didn't think a man who was related to the governor should have to put up with talk like that. Well, Moores told me, he had stood Percy off for as long as he could. And when it became clear to him that Percy was going to try pulling some strings to get me reprimanded and moved to another part of the prison, at the very least, he, Moores, had pulled Percy into his office and told him that if he quit rocking the boat, Moores would make sure that Percy was out front for Delacroix's execution, that he would, in fact, be placed right beside the chair. I would be in charge, as always, but the witnesses wouldn't know that. To them it would look as if Mr. Percy Wetmore was boss of the cotillion. Moores wasn't promising any more than what we'd already discussed, and I'd agreed to, but Percy didn't know that. He agreed to leave off his threats to have me reassigned, and the atmosphere on E Block sweetened. He had even agreed that Delacroix could keep Percy's old nemesis as a pet. It's amazing how some men can change, given the right incentive. In Percy's case, all Warden Moores had to offer was the chance to take a bald little Frenchman's life.
Chapter 9 Toot Toot felt that 4 cents was far too little for a prime Corona cigar box, and in that he was probably right. Cigar boxes were highly prized objects in prison. 1,000 different small items could be stored in them, the smell was pleasant, and there was something about them that reminded our customers of what it was like to be free men. Because cigarettes were permitted in prison, but cigars were not, I imagine. Dean Stanton, who was back on the block by then, added a penny to the pot, and I kicked one in as well. When Toot still proved reluctant, Brutal went to work on him, first telling him he ought to be ashamed of himself for behaving like such a cheapskate, then promising him that he, Brutus Howell, would personally put that Corona box back in Toot's hands the day after Delacroix's execution.
6 cents might or might not be enough if he was speaking about selling that cigar box. We could have a good old barbershop argument about that, Brutal said. But you have to admit it's a great price for renting one. He's going to walk the mile in a month, 6 weeks at the very outside. Why, that box will be back on your shelf under your cot almost before you know it's gone.
He could get his soft-hearted judge to give him a stay and still be here to sing Should Old Acquaintances Be Forgot, Toot said.
But he knew better, and Brutal knew he did. Old Toot-Toot had been pushing that damned Bible-quoting cart of his around Cold Mountain since Pony Express days, practically, and he had plenty of sources. Better than ours, I thought then. He knew Delacroix was fresh out of soft-hearted judges. All he had left to hope for was the governor, who, as a rule, didn't issue clemency to folks who had baked half a dozen of his constituents.
"Even if he don't get a stay, that mouse would be shitting in that box until October, maybe even Thanksgiving,"
Toot argued. But Brutal could see he was weakening.
"Who gonna buy a cigar box some mouse been using for a toilet?"
"Oh, jeez Louise," Brutal said. "That's the numbest thing I ever heard you say, Toot. I mean, that takes the cake. First, Delacroix will keep the box clean enough to eat a church dinner out of. The way he loves that mouse, he'd lick it clean if that's what it took."
"Easy on that stuff," Toot said, wrinkling his nose.
"Second," Brutal went on, "mouse shit is no big deal anyway. It's just hard little pellets. Looks like birdshot. Shake it right out. Nothing to it."
Old Toot knew better than to carry his protest any further. He'd been on the yard long enough to understand when he could afford to face into the breeze and when he'd do better to bend in the hurricane. This wasn't exactly a hurricane, but we blue suits liked the mouse, and we liked the idea of Delacroix having the mouse, and that meant it was at least a gale. So Delacroix got his box, and Percy was as good as his word. 2 days later, the bottom was lined with soft pads of cotton batting from the dispensary. Percy handed them over himself, and I could see the fear in Delacroix's eyes as he reached out through the bars to take them. He was afraid Percy would grab his hand and break his fingers. I was a little afraid of it, too, but no such thing happened. That was the closest I ever came to liking Percy, but even then it was hard to mistake the look of cool amusement in his eyes. Delacroix had a pet, Percy had one, too. Delacroix would keep his, petting it and loving it as long as he could. Percy would wait patiently as a man like him could anyway, and then burn his alive.
"Massey Hilton open for business," Harry said. "The only question is, will a little bugger use it?"
That question was answered as soon as Delacroix caught Mr. Jingles up in one hand and lowered him gently into the box. The mouse snuggled into the white cotton as if it were Aunt Bee's comforter, and that was his home from then until... well, I'll get to the end of Mr. Jingle's story pretty directly. Old Toot Toot's worries that the cigar box would fill up with mouse shit proved to be entirely groundless. I never saw a single turd in there, and Delacroix said he never did either, anywhere in his cell, for that matter. Much later, around the time Brutal showed me the hole in the beam and we found the colored splinters, I moved a chair out of the restraint room's east corner and found a little pile of mouse turds back there. He had always gone back to the same place to do his business, seemingly, and as far from us as he could get. Here's another thing. I never saw him peeing. And usually mice can hardly turn the faucet off for 2 minutes at a time, especially while they're eating. I told you the damned thing was one of God's mysteries. A week or so after Mr. Jingles had settled into the cigar box, Delacroix called me and Brutal down to his cell to see something. He did that so much it was annoying. If Mr. Jingles so much as rolled over on his back with his paws in the air, it was the cutest thing on God's earth as far as that half-pint Cajun was concerned. But this time what he was up to really was sort of amusing. Delacroix had been pretty much forgotten by the world following his conviction, but he had one relation, an old maiden aunt, I believe, who wrote him once a week. She had also sent him an enormous bag of peppermint candies, a sort which are marketed under the name Canada Mints these days. They looked like big pink pills. Delacroix was not allowed to have the whole bag at once, naturally. It was a 5-pounder, and he would have gobbled them until he had to go to the infirmary with stomach gripes. Like almost every murderer we ever had on the mile, he had absolutely no understanding of moderation. We'd give them out to him half a dozen at a time, and only then if he remembered to ask. Mr. Jingles was sitting beside Delacroix on the bunk when we got down there, holding one of those pink candies in his paws and munching contentedly away at it. Delacroix was simply overcome with delight. He was like a classical pianist watching his 5-year-old son play his first halting classical passages. But don't get me wrong, it was funny. A real hoot. The candy was half the size of Mr. Jingles, and his white-furred belly was already distended from it. "Take it away from him, Eddie," Brutal said, half laughing and half horrified. "Christ almighty Jesus, he'll eat till he busts. I can smell that peppermint from here. How many of you let him have?"
"This his second," Delacroix said, looking a little nervously at Mr. Jingle's belly. "You really think he, you know, boss his guts?"
"Might," Brutal said. That was enough authority for Delacroix. He reached for the half-eaten pink mint. I expected the mouse to nip him, but it gave over that mint, what remained of it anyway, as meek as could be. I looked at Brutal, and Brutal gave his head a little shake, as if to say no, he didn't understand it either. Then Mr. Jingles plopped down into his box and lay there on his side in an exhausted way that made all three of us laugh. After that, we got used to seeing the mouse sitting beside Delacroix, holding a mint and munching away on it just as neatly as an old lady at an afternoon tea party, both of them surrounded by what I later smelled in that hole in the beam, the half-bitter, half-sweet smell of peppermint candy. There's one more thing to tell you about Mr. Jingles before moving on to the arrival of William Wharton, which was when the cyclone really touched down on E Block. A week or so after the incident of the peppermint candies, around the time when we'd pretty much decided Delacroix wasn't going to feed his pet to death, in other words, the Frenchman called me down to his cell. I was on my own for the time being, Brutal over at the commissary for something, and according to the regs, I was not supposed to approach a prisoner in such circumstances. But since I probably could have shot-putted Delacroix 20 yards one-handed on a good day, I decided to break the rule and see what he wanted.
"Watch this," Boss Edgecombe said. "You're going to see what Mr. Jingles can do."
He reached behind the cigar box and brought up a small wooden spool. "Where'd you get that?" I asked him, although I supposed I knew. There was really only one person he could have gotten it from.
"Oh, toot toot," he said, "watch this."
I was already watching, and could see Mr. Jingles in his box, standing up with his small front paws propped on the edge, his black eyes fixed on the spool Delacroix was holding between the thumb and first finger of his right hand. I felt a funny little chill go up my back. I had never seen a mere mouse attend to something with such sharpness, with such intelligence, and I never have since. I don't really believe that Mr. Jingles was a supernatural visitation, and if I have given you that idea, I'm sorry, but I have never doubted that he was a genius of his kind. Delacroix bent over and rolled the threadless spool across the floor of his cell. It went easily, like a pair of wheels connected by an axle. The mouse was out of its box in a flash and across the floor after it, like a dog chasing after a stick. I exclaimed with surprise, and Delacroix smiled. The spool hit the wall and rebounded. Mr. Jingles went around it and pushed it back to the bunk, switching from one end of the spool to the other whenever it looked like it was going to veer off course. He pushed the spool until it hit Delacroix's foot. Then it looked up at him for a moment, as if to make sure Delacroix had no more immediate tasks for it, a few arithmetic problems to solve, perhaps, or some Latin to parse. Apparently satisfied on this score, it went back to the cigar box and settled down in it again. "You taught him that," I said. "Yes, sir, Boss Edgecombe," Delacroix said, his smile only slightly dissembling. "He fetch it every time. Smart as hell, ain't he?" "And the spool?" I asked. "How did you know to fetch that for him, Eddie?" "He whispered in my ear that he wanted," Delacroix said serenely, "same as he whispered his name." Delacroix showed all the other guys his mouse's trick, all except Percy. To Delacroix it didn't matter that Percy had suggested the cigar box and procured the cotton with which to line it. Delacroix was like some dogs. Kick them once, and they never trust you again, no matter how nice you are to them. I can hear Delacroix now, yelling, "Hey, you guys, come and see what Mr. Jingles can do." and them going down in a blue suit cluster, Brutal, Harry, Dean, even Bill Dodge. All of them had been properly amazed, too, the same as I had been. 3 or 4 days after Mr. Jingle started doing the trick with the spool, Harry Terwilliger rummaged through the arts and crafts stuff we kept in the restraint room, found the Crayolas, and brought them to Delacroix with a smile that was almost embarrassed.
"I thought you might like to make that spool different colors," he said. "Then your little pal would be like a circus mouse or something."
"A circus mouse?" Delacroix said, looking completely rapturously happy. I suppose he was completely happy, maybe for the first time in his whole miserable life.
"That just what he is, too, a circus mouse. When I get out of here, he's going to make me rich like in a circus. You see if he don't."
Percy Wetmore would no doubt have pointed out to Delacroix that when he left Cold Mountain, he'd be riding in an ambulance that didn't need to run its siren. But Harry knew better. He just told Delacroix to make the spool as colorful as he could, as quick as he could, because he'd have to take the crayons back after dinner. Del made it colorful, all right. When he was done, one end of the spool was yellow, the other end was green, and the drum in the middle was firehouse red. We got used to hearing Delacroix trumpet,
"Maintenant, messieurs et mesdames, sacre présentement les mouse amusant et amaisant."
That wasn't exactly it, but it gives you an idea of that stewpot French of his. Then he'd make this sound way down in his throat, I think it was supposed to represent a drum roll, and fling the spool. Mr. Jingles would be after it in a flash, either nosing it back or rolling it with his paws. That second way really was something you would have paid to see in a circus, I think. Delacroix and his mouse's brightly colored spool were our chief amusements at the time that John Coffey came into our care and custody, and that was the way things remained for a while. Then my urinary infection, which had lain still for a while, came back, and William Wharton arrived, and all hell broke loose. Chapter 10. The dates have mostly slipped out of my head. I suppose I could have my granddaughter, Danielle, look some of them out of the old newspaper files, but what would be the point? The most important of them, like the day we came down to Delacroix's cell and found the mouse sitting on his shoulder, or the day William Wharton came on the block and almost killed Dean Stanton, would not be in the papers anyway. Maybe it's better to just go on as I have been. In the end, I guess the dates don't matter much, if you can remember the things you saw and keep them in the right order. I know that things got squeezed together a little. When Delacroix's DOE papers finally came to me from Curtis Anderson's office, I was amazed to see that our Cajun pal's date with old Sparky had been moved up from when we had expected, a thing that was almost unheard of, even in those days, when you didn't have to move half of heaven and all the earth to execute a man. It was a matter of 2 days, I think, from the 27th of October to the 25th. Don't hold me to it exactly, but I know that's close. I remember thinking that Toot was going to get his corona box back even sooner than he had expected. Wharton, meanwhile, got to us later than expected. For one thing, his trial ran 4 or 5 days longer than Anderson's usually reliable sources had thought it would. When it came to Wild Billy, nothing was reliable, we would soon discover, including our time-tested and supposedly foolproof methods of prisoner control. Then, after he had been found guilty, that much at least when according to the script, he was taken to Indianola General Hospital for tests. He had had a number of supposed seizures during the trial, twice serious enough to send him crashing to the floor, where he lay shaking and flopping and drumming his feet on the boards. Wharton's court-appointed lawyer claimed he suffered from epilepsy spells and had committed his crimes while of unsound mind. The prosecution claimed the fits were the sham acting of a coward desperate to save his own life. After observing the so-called epilepsy spells at first hand, the jury decided the fits were an act. The judge concurred, but ordered a series of pre-sentencing tests after the verdict came down. God knows why, perhaps he was only curious. It's a blue-eyed wonder that Wharton didn't escape from the hospital, and the irony that Warden Moores's wife, Melinda, was in the same hospital at the same time did not escape any of us. But he didn't. They had him surrounded by guards, I suppose, and perhaps he still had hopes of being declared incompetent by reason of epilepsy, if there is such a thing. He wasn't. The doctors found nothing wrong with his brain, physiologically at least, and Billy the Kid Wharton was at last bound for Cold Mountain. That might have been around the 18th. It's my recollection that Wharton arrived about 2 weeks after John Coffey, and a week or so before Delacroix walked the Green Mile. The day our new psychopath joined us was an eventful one for me. I woke up at 4 that morning with my groin throbbing and my penis feeling hot and clogged and swollen. Even before I swung my feet out of bed, I knew that my urinary infection wasn't getting better as I had hoped. It had been a brief turn for the better, that was all, and it was over. I went out to the privy to do my business, this was at least 3 years before we put in our first water closet, and had gotten no further than the wood pile at the corner of the house when I realized I couldn't hold it any longer. I lowered my pajama pants just as the urine started to flow, and that flow was accompanied by the most excruciating pain of my entire life. I passed a gallstone in 1956, and I know people say that is the worst, but that gallstone was like a touch of acid indigestion compared to this outrage. My knees came unhinged, and I fell heavily onto them, tearing out the seat of my pajama pants when I spread my legs to keep from losing my balance and going face first into a puddle of my own piss. I still might have gone over if I hadn't grabbed one of the woodpile logs with my left hand. All that, though, could have been going on in Australia, or even on another planet. All I was concerned with was the pain that had set me on fire. My lower belly was burning, and my penis, an organ which had gone mostly forgotten by me, except when providing me the most intense physical pleasure a man can experience, now felt as if it was melting. I expected to look down and see blood gushing from its tip, but it appeared to be a perfectly ordinary stream of urine. I hung on to the woodpile with one hand and put the other across my mouth, concentrating on keeping my mouth shut. I did not want to frighten my wife awake with a scream. It seemed that I went on pissing forever, but at last the stream dried up. By then the pain had sunk deep into my stomach and my testicles, biting like rusty teeth. For a long while, it might have been as long as a minute, I was physically incapable of getting up. At last the pain began to abate, and I struggled to my feet. I looked at my urine already soaking into the ground, and wondered if any sane god could make a world where such a little bit of dampness could come at the cost of such horrendous pain. I would call in sick, I thought, and go see Dr. Sadler after all. I didn't want the stink and the queasiness of Dr. Sadler's sulfa tablets, but anything would be better than kneeling beside the woodpile, trying not to scream, while my prick was reporting that it had apparently been doused with coal oil and set afire. Then, as I was swallowing aspirin in our kitchen and listening to Jan snore lightly in the other room, I remembered that today was the day William Wharton was scheduled on the block, and that Brutal wouldn't be there. The roster had him over on the other side of the prison, helping to move the library and some leftover infirmary equipment to the new building. One thing I didn't feel right about, in spite of my pain, was leaving Wharton to Dean and Harry. They were good men, but Curtis Anderson's report had suggested that William Wharton was exceptionally bad news. "This man just doesn't care," he had written, underlining for emphasis. By then the pain had abated some, and I could think. The best idea, it seemed to me, was to leave for the prison early. I could get there at 6, which was the time Warden Moores usually came in. He could get Brutus Howell reassigned to E Block long enough for Wharton's reception, and I'd make my long overdue trip to the doctor. Cold Mountain was actually on my way. Twice, on the 20-mile ride to the penitentiary, that sudden need to take a leak overcame me. Both times, I was able to pull over and take care of the problem without embarrassing myself. For one thing, traffic on country roads at such an hour was all but non-existent. Neither of these two voidings was as painful as the one that had taken me off my feet on the way to the privy, but both times I had to clutch the passenger side door handle of my little Ford coupe to hold myself up, and I could feel sweat running down my hot face. I was sick, all right, good and sick. I made it, though, drove in through the south gate, parked in my usual place, and went right up to see the warden. It was going on 6 o'clock by then. Miss Hannah's office was empty. She wouldn't be in until the relatively